Welcome to China Manufacturing Decoded from Sofeast, the podcast where we take you through some of the major topics facing importers and manufacturers in China today.
Hello again, listener. Thanks for tuning into episode 28 of the podcast. Adrian from Sofeast here, and I'm joined by our CEO, Renaud Angerin, today, and we'll be discussing good manufacturing practices, so that's GMPs. These are usually most commonly used in industries where safety is extremely paramount. So we're talking the food industry, medical devices, and also pharmaceutical. But it's not uncommon that some brands apply their own GMPs today, and you don't need to be a large company in order to build out and start using your own GMPs. So we'll find out what they are, why they're useful, and how you can implement them yourself in this episode. Hi, Renaud. Glad to have you with me today. How are you doing?
Hey there. Fine. And you?
Lovely, thanks. Yes. So catching up with you today about good manufacturing practices, I think this is something that is going to be useful to a lot of the listeners who are importers and they're having production in Asia or elsewhere. So let's get started by just talking about what GMPs actually are.
Well, the first thing is it's highly dependent on the type of manufacturing and, you know, the type of product and how safe the product has to be and so on and so forth. Highly dependent. Maybe we can cover food, medical, just to give a little bit of to give an idea of what's in there. But
sure,
it's the idea itself is not a bad idea. It is okay when it comes to manufacturing and you know, storing the materials and so on. I mean, it's all around the manufacturing. What are the key things, the basic things that have to be done well and carefully? This is really the basic idea, right? So obviously if you make bricks versus if you make furniture versus if you make food products, it's going to be extremely different. But for all of them, there are some good practices. And usually we talk about good practices to with the purpose of maintaining a certain level of quality or safety. It's usually not related to efficiency, cost, you know, usually not related to speed. I mean, it's very much about quality and safety.
Okay. You mentioned at the very start of your explanation there that GMPs actually may not be so relevant for all kinds of products. And you mentioned in particular medical, food, which of course anyone can imagine safety is going to be particularly critical here. So, I mean, if they're not relevant for all kinds of products, aside from safety of food and medical products, what other kinds of products are we particularly looking at here?
Basically all the products with high safety and or high quality requirements. Maybe not extremely high, but where the buyer or the regulator doesn't want a serious lapse in safety or in quality. And I mean, one can document a set of good practices for any kind of manufacturing, of course. I'm just saying that it's more relevant for certain kinds of products than others, right? That's what I mean. So I have seen some pretty generic GMP checklists, if you want, usually put together by a buyer. So for some buyers try to, you know, get organized and they say, well, you know, what's sort of the minimum that we want our manufacturers to do? Now you're going to say, hey, that sounds like ISO 9001, and Yes, it does sound like ISO 9001 a little bit. Now, ISO 9001 itself is very generic. It's supposed to be applicable to any kind of service, products, whatever. So it's very, very generic. And so an auditor needs to use his brain and try to think, okay, for this kind of situation here, what's really important and so on. When it comes to second party auditing, large importers and retailers often want to have their own checklist, so that's fine for, let's say, the quality system. Okay, now some of them insist specifically on manufacturing practices simply because it's physical, it's something that their auditors can see, it's something where they can drive improvement, and improvement is not going to be games and around documents, is going to be usually physical right there. Hey, you need a fixture to hold that when you're assembling, otherwise how can you maintain the proper level of quality? Hey, you need to label these materials here, we don't know what they're doing here, we don't know if it's good or bad, we don't know if it's processed or not processed. Hey, this is really dirty, you need to clean it, these kinds of things. It's not about documents. The good thing is when you focus an auditor on this and you focus the manufacturer on these kind of things, the type of improvement to make is pretty obvious, how to make it is pretty obvious, and checking it is relatively easy. So it can make sense to focus the suppliers on this kind of physical sort of improvements where the evidence is physical. That's what I mean. In contrast with the absolute opposite of this is social compliance audits, where you go there and then you ask people, so I don't really trust the documents that I'm shown, so how many days did you work last month, and it's all about humans and what they say and how they treat each other. And sometimes it can be pretty tough to know exactly what happened. Now, this is the exact opposite. And with Chinese suppliers and Vietnamese suppliers and Indian suppliers, if you focus them on something, you're going to have better results than if you go with a very broad sort of checklist and you look at a number of different things that are not very directly related, and then they don't really know where to start. And you say, so have you made some progress? And they're like, yeah, sure. Right. But what's really important for them? We don't know. So we don't know what to do. Okay. Now you focus it more on the physical stuff, and you can get them to improve better. And it's much harder to give, fake documents, fake evidence to your auditors also, if it's all based on physical evidence. Some retailers do that, like Costco, for example. They have a checklist. It's not very, it's not so advanced, right? It's not extremely advanced. It's not like, solid process auditing or anything like that. But it's a good basis, and it can really be applied on many different kinds of products. And as you're gonna say, it's Costco, it's not Tiffany. So it applies for relatively cheap products also, right? And it's, I respect this approach. In some cases it makes better sense than more general quality system types of audits, where the auditor might spend much time in a conference room looking at documents, right?
So if you've developed your GMPs like Costco, for example, I'm assuming then that this would be put into the manufacturing agreement, that these would be followed?
Not necessarily. This can be used for the initial qualification of a potential supplier, so that will be before they sign an agreement, just to be considered, and then it can be done every 6 months, every year. They can you can follow up with that, see if there is improvement, and basically tell them, hey, if you improve and you get over that score, we'll give you more orders. If you if your score actually goes down or stays pretty weak, then you'll be less likely to get new orders, you know, and there's a point where we just cut you off. This doesn't even have to be in a manufacturing contract, actually. It's the carrot and the stick in addition to the contract.
Right. Yeah, I got it. Okay. Yeah, makes sense. So if we look in a little bit more detail at GMPs, that's kind of the theory behind them. So what are the kinds of principles that are likely to be included in a GMP? So, you know, what's the anatomy of a typical sort of list of GMPs that you might find?
Well, if it's for, let's say, general consumer goods,
right?
It's things like how do you store the materials? You know, certain materials need to be stored only for a limited duration of time. Maybe they need to be stored in a humidity controlled, maybe even temperature controlled area, and so on. And you know, and then when it gets into production, how do they actually segregate the conforming material versus non-conforming material? How do they ensure that the production equipment is properly maintained, is not going to work abnormally or even break down? You know, so that leads to preventive maintenance. How do they make sure that the people working on the fabrication or the assembly have been trained, have the proper experience? Well, this can lead into training recalls and things like that. But on a more basic level, is there sort of a little program to get them trained and until it's okay when they start slowly working on the product? And can they just put someone right there, you know, without any specific follow-up and training when the regular guy is sick, you know? So staff competency, let's say, when they check actually the incoming materials, when they check maybe during production or after production, do they have an appropriate method, and do they have approved samples, and do they have a checklist, and what, you know, what does the sampling look like? Does it make sense? What kind of testing or measuring instruments do they have? Are they within the calibration or verification period? It's all these kinds of things, you know. It's how it could even extend to planning, maybe, to avoid making very large batches that then have to be stored in inventory for who knows how long. It could be a lot of things. So, these are the kind of specific things. This is very, very generic. And then some buyers try to have more specific ones for certain kinds of productions, right? So if they buy a lot of, I don't know, of metal products that goes through die casting and then CNC machining, they're going to have some specific, you know, maybe a subset of the checklist that will apply to that. Oh, it's, you know, there's casting. So, you know, the purity of the material and how do they check is, you know, it's kept clean and without anything going into it and everything. How do they prepare the parts? I mean, after the casting, how do they, you know, the mold? How do they confirm that the mold is okay? How do they prepare it? What kind of oil do they use? How do they confirm the pressure and the cycle time and everything, you know, during the setting? And is it documented? And there's all kinds of things like that, right? CNC machining, maybe how do they ensure it's always the latest version of the cutting program that's used? Again, preventive maintenance and changing the tools and the bits and everything. So it's very It can go very, very specific, more into what we call a process audit, but usually it doesn't go that far. So what they do usually is they try to think, okay, you know, in the past, whatever, 2 years, 5 years, for that kind of product, what are the kind of problems that come back often? You know, and what are sort of the root causes, or at least the causes of these problems? And then we're gonna just make sure, you know, we're gonna put the focus on that, and we're gonna push our manufacturers to avoid these same issues. Very often that's the way it is. So you look at it and you're like, what kind of logic are they following? But actually it's just based on their past issues. And actually that, you know, that's not a bad approach in itself. It's not a bad approach. So when you talk about general, let's say general consumer goods, a buyer wants to do that, yeah, that's typically what they would do.
The GMPs are quite wide ranging then in some cases. If somebody's auditing a factory based on GMPs, so this is perhaps before they've even become a supplier, is it necessary in all cases that you would go this deep then? As you said, they're almost similar to a process audit, and some importers wouldn't necessarily do the process audit, right?
Yeah, right. So in most cases, it's much more superficial than process audits, than you know, what we call the in-depth process audits. It's more general. It very often it's not specific, as I was, you know, like the casting and the CNC machining example that I was giving. It's more it's more generic. Yeah, most of the time it's more generic, but you know, there is a value in also in generic checkpoints. It's always the same things that come back anyway. It's how do you set the machines and how do you keep them, you know, running well, and how, you know, who are the people, you know, using this equipment or doing the assembly? They have the right competency, and how do you make sure you don't make mistakes with the materials, you know, store them improperly, or mislabel them, or whatever, you know. These kind of things do have some value, definitely.
Okay. And do suppliers usually keep records if they're following GMPs?
I've never seen a supplier, you know, aside from very specific types of products, again, medical, food, pharmaceutical, and so on. Mm-hmm. I've never seen a supplier say we follow GMPs. So it's driven by the buyer usually.
Okay, well, you mentioned specific suppliers in, let's say, the medical or the food field. So let's move on to just talk about those briefly. If we look at the US FDA GMPs for medical devices, I think that these are very commonly found if you're looking on the internet, the kinds of GMPs that are out there. These are to help suppliers maintain a very high standard of quality and safety, of course. What are some of the elements that are likely to be followed with these?
Right. So, if you look in the website, fda.gov, you will find what they call the CGMP, current good manufacturing practices. And, you know, FDA applies to food, drugs, what they call biologics, and some devices, you know, such as medical devices. So this is definitely safety sensitive sort of products. And they actually say right there, you know, because the regulation must apply to so many different types of devices, the regulation does not prescribe in detail how a manufacturer must produce a specific device. It just provides the framework that all manufacturers must follow, by requiring that manufacturers develop and follow procedures and fill in the details that are appropriate to a given device, blah, 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 blah. So that's, you know, if you say, okay, what's the standard for US FDA GMP? Well, I don't know. Basically, all they say is try to have good manufacturing practices, try to have a good quality system, and make sure you document it as much
Right.
as you can, right? So I was talking with my friends from Compliance Gate, and they were saying, yes, make sure you document a certain number of things, and don't get too hung up on what exactly it is that the FDA wants. It's more like if you wanted to do a good job, what would you do, right? So certain things that they generally recommend would be quality control records on incoming materials and components, and also quality control records on outgoing products, basically the pre-shipment inspection. Okay, because that's also part of, the quality system. How actually do you make sure that what you make, what you buy from a manufacturer, or maybe you make in your own manufacturing facility, is going to be acceptable, of high quality, and so on. Well, at least, hey, we've done these quality checks. Okay, good. Traceability records for the materials and components. So that's really, really important, because again, safety sensitive products and relatively high likelihood of a recall if things really go wrong, at least. There's always this looming threat of a recall. Okay. So
Right.
have the traceability to actually, for this batch, we bought these materials from these suppliers, right? And try to keep always a batch level, at least batch level traceability. So that if you have a problem with a few items of the same batch, you don't need to recall everything forever that you have put on the market. You only recall that item from that batch, and then maybe if the problem comes from one component and that component was delivered in three separate batches, then you can maybe hopefully identify, oh, it's only this subset of our batch. Okay, so your recall is even smaller, because a recall can be extremely expensive, can really, it has put some companies out of business. So you need to try to have good traceability. It also helps, definitely helps with failure analysis, trying to understand what went wrong, and then driving corrective actions and setting the right systems for the future. Maintenance, preventive maintenance. Yes, if there is a preventive maintenance plan and some records are generated, that's extremely, extremely, extremely useful. And when we're talking about, food, pharmaceuticals, and things like that, that also includes cleanliness. Okay, you could say preventive maintenance of the facility and the equipment includes cleanliness, of course. They also suggest, what is the machinery, what does the facility look like? Get some photos about that. And what happens on the defective pieces that were found? Were they reworked? How were they retested? Were they just discarded? So that's the kind of things that they recommend. And then you put all this in a technical file, and you have it ready for the time where you might be controlled. You can always add more, right? So if you have developed the product, you will have the design files. Hopefully you have the bill of material, you have the whatever the CAD files, the Gerber files. Also, if you've developed the products, what were the verification and validation stages for qualifying it as ready for mass production, right? Do you have a process? Do you have some records about that? Did you do a pilot run, and so on? So, and you could go keep going on and on and on and deeper, but this usually, I mean, if you do this well, you're already better than what 95% of SMEs do, right? Now, of course, when General Electric makes very expensive products for hospitals and so on, they go beyond that. They do everything very nicely, I guess. But again, talking about SMEs, what I said is usually already way above the average. And obviously, there's different classes of medical devices. Some of them, you know, go inside the body and so on. So, of course, those that really, you know, if they fail, the patient can die. Well, this has to be subject to much more attention and many more preventive actions, okay? Rather than some certain things that qualify as maybe a medical device, but are way, way less important, you know, like something you put on your hair just to make sure that you don't drop your hair everywhere, right?
Yeah.
I don't know what I forget what they call it. A head.
A hairnet?
I forget. Yeah, bonnet. Yeah, something like that.
Something like that.
Or a hairnet. Yeah. Usually it's more than a net because it has to keep all your hair there, right? So different. You look at that, and you look at a pacemaker. I mean, obviously, one of them is it's going to require a lot more preventive thinking. You know, what could go wrong, right? So that's US FDA. Yeah, so they keep it extremely flexible, right? And
sure. When you spoke about the need for, you know, quite strict preventive actions and points like this with regard to very, very important medical devices that simply cannot fail, I suppose that this is going to be dealt with by the relevant ISO certifications for the manufacturers, right?
Not that much, no. And a good ISO 13485 auditor, when he's auditing a factory making, let's say, pacemakers, will ask a lot of these questions. However, this is not covered in ISO 13485, like as prescriptions, right? So you're thinking of, you know, risk analysis at the design stage and the process development stage, and a lot of prototyping and verification and validation and performance tests and accelerated life tests and things like that in extreme temperature, extreme settings. You know, design engineers have to add redundancy. They have to think of you know, bottom up and top down, do different kinds of risk analysis, and then modify their design so that there's lower and lower and lower chance that things go wrong. And then once it's on the market, then you do a failure investigation analysis on every single issue. You really try to get to the bottom of it, and then you iterate version 2, version 3, and so on, always with better odds of having everything go smoothly, right? So, and there's a lot into that. I mean, you know, so big companies that make really complex equipment like that have a heap of specialists, you know, reliability engineers, quality engineers, and so on, all working together just to find ways to make the design more robust, and then to make the manufacturing itself produce as few defects as possible, right? As predictable as possible. So and also they try to understand how are the users really going to use this. So making sure that their tests and validation plans really go above and beyond what the vast majority of users would do to the product, because, you know, users sometimes misunderstand how to use the product. Users make all kinds of mistakes, but in the end, for these kinds of products, if there is a way for the user, even the dumbest user, if there is a way for that user to do things wrong, and he does it wrong, the manufacturer is going to be in trouble. So they have to really think very creatively. And put it in the hands of a lot of users just to testing and to see how they're going to use it and so on. So it's a very wide topic, actually.
Yeah, right.
Things can be done.
And so with the type of device in mind, a skilled auditor would be trying to get that evidence that the manufacturer has taken all of these things into account.
as appropriate. Yes. Again, if it's a hair bonnet for a nurse, it's going to be at a certain level. If it's a pacemaker, it's a different level.
Okay. Yeah, I got it. And another one of the key types of product that you mentioned were food products. So if we look at GMPs for food as well, what sort of GMPs are likely to be in place here if we're talking about food products?
Well, so first, again, there's no one standard. It has to be thought of as, you know, appropriate for the production of this specific kind of product. Typically, there's a lot of focus on hygiene, you know, personal hygiene, facility hygiene, premise hygiene, you know, cleanliness and more than that. But really, it's highly dependent. And it's called different ways in different for different kinds of food productions, actually. If you look at ISO 22001, which is the management system requirements for food safety, they don't actually call it GMP because they actually say, oh, it can be called GMP, it can be called this, that. Okay. They call it prerequisite. In their logic, it is the things that you have to have in place actually before you start producing, because it's so basic that you really don't want to make any kind of food or beverage in a place that doesn't have even the you know, the proper level of hygiene. So they call it prerequisite. And they really leave it at that. They say, you know, whatever is appropriate. So it's really sort of up to the auditor. And then they pile up some other specific requirements, hazard analysis and so on. But so usually what does it mean? You know, obviously you want pest control. You don't want people to smoke in the warehouse. Things to be clean. How do you dispose of rubbish, of internal organs, and so on and so forth, right? Water supply, you know, do you need a high purity of water or just a tap? Is it okay? Do you need to do something? You need to boil it? Right? So it's a lot of things and it's highly specific. Having said that, some countries have set up, what they call the GMP, their own GMP standards. And it's sort of different from one country to another. And sometimes it's necessary for exporting and importing food products. But the logics are not very well aligned. Again, it's not one standard. And then even when you look at the sort of authorizations, if you want, for importing food products from certain countries, the exporting country, the manufacturing country, can issue that kind of sort of certificate that it was made according to good manufacturing practices. But it's the logic is different from one country to another and so on. So it's actually quite messy.
Right. And hearing the points that you've made about the medical or the food products, you know, for example, pest control, being able to dispose of rubbish safely, the hygiene of the people actually producing the food, for example, all of this seems to be grounded in common sense. And I suppose I see that running through the whole GMP idea. Yeah, it's very much based in common sense.
Yes. Ideally, you know, when it's well thought out, you could say that, yes.
Right, okay.
It's the kind of basic things that you want them to do. And if they don't do it, I mean, nobody's going to dispute that, hey, no, we don't need to do it, right? It's really okay. Basic.
Yeah, okay, makes sense. So to just wrap up then, if you are a buyer and you are sourcing suppliers abroad, or you're already working with suppliers abroad, and you are looking to implement some GMPs, how would you start going about doing that?
Well, you need to, you know, think of what are your the products that the product categories that you work on the most. Is it for safety? So anything related to food, medical, pharmaceutical, and so on, or is it more general consumer goods? The approach is a bit different, but in both cases, you need to think of what are the basic things that you want all of your manufacturers to do at least reasonably well, right? Are you going to use this in your supplier qualification process? Are you going to use this in your ongoing program for re-auditing the suppliers? Or are you going to do it in a more traditional way with management system audits that are a bit closer to ISO 9001? Of course, they can be highly configured also, right? So think about your objectives, think about the scope, where you want to go, if it's really only about the way the materials are let's say managed, handled, and the way manufacturing is done, then that's, you can call this GMP. If you want to go further, it might be a quasi system audit. It might include social compliance, might include environmental compliance. It might include a lot of other things. Mm. And then once you have the objective, once you have the scope, what are the criteria, right? So you need to develop a checklist. And, typically the way we do when we develop a checklist is we do a big brainstorm and we think of a number of things. We organize them by logically by categories, by areas, if you want. And then we do a few audits just to, because when you do the audits, you're going to think. So have an experienced auditor use it, do a few audits, improve the checklist over time, and you'll get to version one ready to go, basically. Then after that, over time, if you work across two or three big product categories, you might want to have a subset of the checklist that is product category specific. You might have one, one for shoes and one for garments, for example, cut and sew garments, right? That's still pretty wide, but it's a big step up from a very generic kind of checklist.
Sure. Great summary there. Thanks. You've written some extra content regarding GMPs before, so I'll leave the links to those in the show notes. And throughout, we have mentioned different kinds of audits as well. That has been discussed here on the podcast before. So I will also link to these. So anyone listening can catch up on those as well. So that's it for today. Thanks, Renaud, for joining me.
Great. Thanks, Adrien.
No worries. Thanks for joining us. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, don't forget to like and share. And you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all other places that you get your podcasts from. See you next time.